Tristram Hicks, hi. Thank you so much for agreeing to be on the Asset Reality Cease and Desist podcast. I personally am delighted that I was asked to discuss all things asset recovery with you, all things asset recovery and management, not least because we've worked together, I think, for over 20 years. I think we first met at the old UK National Asset Recovery Agency back in 2004 in London, when I was given a talk on the opportunities for international cooperation to the ORA staff there, when I still worked at Europol at the Asset Seizure Centre. But mostly I'm pleased because I don't know anyone internationally who's got the kind of breadth of experience that you have in asset recovery right across the board, really, from working nationally at the coalface to kind of drafting and implementing whole new proceeds of crime legislation, all the way through to more recently, where you've worked internationally, often with me, capacity building and teaching governments how to confiscate more assets. Rather than me try and introduce you, can I ask you to try and give us a flavour by introducing yourself?
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, Jill, and nice to see you. And thanks to Asset Reality for the chance to have this chat. We met in 2004. At that time, I was head of the regional asset recovery team in London, which was a newly established team. And we were implementing, in operational terms, the Proceeds of Crime Act. I'm going to talk about the Proceeds of Crime Act 2003, which was the piece of UK legislation that allowed us to do asset recovery at scale for the very first time. And although there was previous legislation, it didn't really work. And there were just a few dozen cases, mostly done by customs. The police weren't really involved in asset recovery at all pre-POCA. And then post-POCA, suddenly everything changed in a really big way. And we went from a few dozen, perhaps 100 cases nationally, all agencies, to between 5,000 and 7,000 cases a year. Like, I can't emphasize enough the scale of the change. And I just happened to be in the right place. I was the head of financial intelligence for Scotland Yard at the time and was on the national committee dealing with implementing the Proceeds of Crime Act. It was a really exciting time because I was dealing with operational command, real cases, and also directing or having a say in policy and how the Act was implemented and discovering how asset recovery worked. Because at that point, we didn't know.
I mean, so the Proceeds of Crime Act in 2002, you were in it right from the beginning there. And I think it's fair to say it wasn't an easy ask, the legislation. I mean, you focused a lot on building a decent piece of law. And I'd like to ask you a little bit about the cash seizure powers in that law later on. But from there, how easy was it to actually get England and Wales, get the nation to apply this, what was seen at the time as a real kind of draconian piece of legislation and a completely different way of working?
Yeah, I mean, and you're right. It did change everything. But some things were the same. We had a new piece of legislation and lots of countries pass new legislation about asset recovery. And then they wonder why things don't happen, which is the typical experience. Most countries don't do asset recovery at all. Most don't do financial investigation because they don't have financial investigators. And they don't have financial investigators because law enforcement and the justice system see this as extra work and they're already overloaded. They're already with full in-trays. They don't have time to do this extra thing called financial investigation. They don't see it as a way to tackle crime more effectively. They don't see it as a way to bring money into the criminal justice system. They don't see it as a way to reduce crime overall. And it does all of those things. I mean, I hesitate to say that it's a silver bullet, but it's utility to use it against all sorts of crime. So we talk about economic crime and fraud. But what about drug dealing? What about human trafficking? What about corruption? Well, all of these crimes, if we think like criminals and want to make money, then asset recovery is the antidote. And that's pretty obvious, really. What I found was there was a lack of understanding by senior officers in particular who are used to running big organisations, but they're not particularly used to investigation. They don't come from investigative backgrounds. They don't necessarily come from anti-crime backgrounds, which sounds strange for policing. But the reality is they're dealing with public order and the reputation of the justice system and fairness and all sorts of other worthwhile things. And crime for money is on the list. And POCA allows you to tackle it in a really effective way.
So the UK, you know, it's fair to say, not only the UK, there are some other jurisdictions who were already out there with their recognition that, you know, crime's motivated by money and that we needed to do something about this. And another reason for asking if you would join us on a podcast is that you recently commented on the introduction of the new Financial Action Task Force guidelines that followed the amended recommendations. And, you know, you mentioned senior officers there, and I think this is probably very closely linked to your comments and your reflections on the FATF guidelines, because basically you said these were welcome introduction. You're glad that they were amended and that these guidelines were introduced. I mean, it was 2012 since the last guidelines, but really, why do you feel that they may have missed the point there? What is it that they are not really addressing? Why is it so important to kind of focus this in the right area?
And the first thing to say about the Financial Action Task Force is I'm a fan of the FATF. I mean, I really am. I'm very supportive of their work. They have a real level of global clout. They do thorough evaluations of countries and they have a global reach through their regional bodies. It's a really important organisation and I think it's very effective at raising the issue of financial intelligence. The guidance on asset recovery was the first guidance on asset recovery issued at a global level. You know, that's a really important milestone. Their previous guidance on financial investigation back in 2012 was another milestone. And their move towards effectiveness, actual effectiveness, operational effectiveness, as they call it, is a move away a little bit from the recommendations. The recommendations are important, but operational effectiveness speaks to law enforcement. It speaks to asset recovery as the antidote to crime. And that's a really important change. And they're saying the right things. Asset recovery is on the president's, by which I mean the president of the FATF, on her agenda. Mm. And she's put it in the right place. And the guidance speaks to that emphasis on asset recovery. I don't think that the FATF is particularly talking to criminal justice effectively. And I do think that's a missing element. They talk to the central banks, they talk to financial intelligence units and the financial sector. But to persuade criminal justice to deliver the asset recovery that we all want requires a special way of talking to those people. And that's where I felt the guidance was missing. And that's why I commented on the need for cultural change, always the most difficult area. And I gave some real tangible ways that the culture could be changed through the FATF and its evaluation process. So, yeah, they're doing really well. And the guidance was a great step forward. But there is more. And that's why I wrote that piece to help the FATF deliver in reality.
And one of the changes that we saw there is that they do now underscore the importance of making asset recovery a policy priority. But, you know, you and I traveled around to various jurisdictions trying to support governments to introduce better asset recovery laws and processes. And quite often we were told, oh, yes, asset recovery is definitely a priority for us as a jurisdiction. But when we looked there, actually, all the policy aspects were hidden within anti-corruption policies or national anti-money laundering policies. And there was maybe one line that focused on asset recovery and why that's important. What do you think needs to change to raise that profile? You know, what is it that we can ask jurisdictions to do and how can we get them to change?
I think looking at the UK is a really good example of a before and after. And the reason I say that is because the Proceeds to Crime Act in the UK was a particularly good piece of legislation. And one thing I'd say is why bother inventing legislation from scratch when you can just go to the UK and get their Proceeds to Crime Act, pick out the things that are important and pass law like that. And the UK had an implementation committee, and that's often missing from actually the UK was unusual in having its own implementation committee. That isn't a normal thing for it to do. And other countries need to implement this because it's quite difficult. If it was easy, you wouldn't need to read my book, The War on Dirty Money, which talks about some of the issues. And some this key understanding, somehow we've separated the proceeds of crime and asset recovery from crime. So we organisationally deal with it separately. When we talk about statistics and what gets measured gets done, we separate the proceeds of crime and asset recovery from crime and crime reduction. And we need to join those things together. And a multi-agency committee allows you to do that. One of the difficulties with asset recovery is it's split between the ministries in government who tend to operate, unfortunately, as silos. And I think we all understand the importance of that and why that's good in some ways and bad in others. But we have the Ministry of Interior, the Ministry of Finance, the Foreign Ministry and the Ministry of Justice. Those four key ministries worked separately in the UK. And luckily, we had a Prime Minister at the time who brought heads together. And the role of the Prime Minister in making it happen is really important, including the decision to recycle the assets back to the agencies. It was very difficult to persuade police and prosecutors and the courts to do this extra work. And the money coming back into the system really helped to buy some people within the system to do the work. So you need the law, you need the people to do the work, and you need some strategic push. The fourth thing is a catalyst to make it work, the spark that turns law into practice. And that was a surprising thing in the UK. We didn't know what that spark would be. It was exciting to discover it, to be honest. It was hidden in the legislation. Hidden in legislation that all countries already have. And this is the power to seize cash at the borders. And in the UK, that was already a dozen years old at the time when POCA came in, but it was a power only used at the frontier, only used by customs. So police, we didn't know about it. Just wasn't something we recognised. So when the power came in, it was kind of an extra piece of legislation, a bit of the Proceeds of Crime Act. And we put it into practice. We found out what customs did and said, you know, in fact, one of my officers was walking past my office and I said, Steve, can you go to customs? They're having a meeting tomorrow and they're talking about cash seizure, whatever that is. Go and find out what they do. Bring it back here. And the result of that is I ended up writing the guidance for seizing cash in the UK. We had a presentation for all the forces in the UK to deliver the cash seizure process. And suddenly we were seizing millions and then tens of millions of pounds in folding money. It was absolutely incredible. And previously, we'd found it, but we just left it where it was because we'd been trained not to seize cash like every other police force in the world. That was the change.
It's something that both you and I talked about a lot when we were travelling through jurisdictions, that there was, you know, a big push to consider non-conviction-based civil forfeiture and, you know, as a kind of prior step to that, I think jurisdictions have bought into this kind of extended confiscation regimes. But we didn't find cash forfeiture in any of the jurisdictions that we went to other than at the borders, which was always a great surprise to us. And I think it's, as you say, probably one of the areas that jurisdictions could now pick up on in order to have more money in the pot at the end to use to incentivize law enforcement and incentivize governments to confiscate more assets. Maybe we can talk a little bit about the way that this pot of money at the end of the day can motivate more confiscation. You touched on it briefly there, but the Proceeds of Crime Act also opened up the opportunity for something called the incentivization scheme. Perhaps you can just tell us a little bit about what that is, first of all, and how that is used in the UK to encourage more asset recovery.
It's a really important decision and a difficult decision. And I think the decision in the UK was made by the Prime Minister, basically overruling the Ministry of Finance, because all the Ministry of Finances want to keep all the money for themselves. They're all the same. And let's face it, we want them to keep it safe and to use it wisely. But in this case, the money coming back into the system provided the resource to change people's minds, to change the minds of management, and to provide a few people to do the work at first. And then what we found was it worked. And then we brought more money. And then we went from a few dozen financial investigators to over 100 financial investigators, to hundreds of financial investigations in all agencies all over the country. And it was driven by the results. It was driven by effectiveness. But that spark came from the assets coming back into the system to allow management to make the easy decision to do the extra work, make the hard decision to do the extra work.
Yeah.
And that was really important. And I think the benefit of the proceeds of crime is a deterrent for crime. But deterrent works at scale. You have to have lots of cases. It's not about the numbers of assets and the amount of assets. It's about the numbers of people who were affected. And as I say, we went up to 5,000 to 7,000 cases a year. And that provides the deterrent and it provides the assets to be recycled. And there's an opportunity there to engage with communities. What actually happened in the UK is money was brought back into criminal justice and we spent it on asset recovery and the size of the cake, if you like, got bigger. And over just a few years, it doubled in size and then it doubled again until overall it increased by 14 times under the old legislation, not evenly. So in the Met, it was 30 times and we found we had too much money. And that's the point when we made the decision to do asset reuse and we gave the money to a charity, a crime prevention charity called the Safer Land London Foundation in London. And there were other schemes throughout the country because police forces had too much money to spend. And that connected with communities blighted by crime, providing crime prevention assistance directly saying this came from criminals. This is the proceeds of crime. These assets are being used to benefit communities and bringing it into reality for communities. I think traveling around the world, I've seen examples where asset reuse has engaged communities to say, well, we've got this far. Can we have some more? Can we get some more assets? Why aren't you recovering more? And I think civil society has a role to say, well, firstly, where's the money going?
Yeah.
And secondly, to say, if it's coming to communities, can we have some more? Can you do better at asset recovery? So I think there is a role to engage with the community and for politicians and senior officers to benefit their organisations by connecting with crime blighted communities through support of asset recovery.
Mm-hmm.
It seems an obvious way to do it. And some countries do it well.
And, you know, just want to make that clear for the listeners who may not be aware. I mean, at Asset Reality, we're very often involved in spending time liquidating the assets that we've helped governments seize and manage. For us in particular, for victims to be compensated from those assets. But just for the benefit of the listeners, when we talk about social reuse or the reuse of assets, yes, this is for the benefit of communities, but there are two forms of reuse. And in the UK, we very much focus on what I often call the state reuse of assets, as opposed to giving funds directly to charities and to communities. So the kind of community reuse of assets. Could you just explain really why it's important to focus on the state reuse? And this is actually the funds from the sale of confiscated assets. So not the physical assets that we have confiscated, but it's selling those assets and using the funds from the sale for reuse purposes. Why is that important? Why should we give those funds to law enforcement bodies?
Firstly, the UK system generates money because we tend to sell the assets through a result of the British system, which is slightly different from other parts of the world where actual assets, actual land and real estate is physically handed over by the courts to communities. And so there's a slight difference. There are two things, really. Money's very flexible and you can account for it. And it also means that you can generate a stream of income, which is always so important for civil society and for government reuse, to have that certainty that the thing you're buying is going to be supported in the future. So it's all very well having a car, but have you got the money to buy the petrol? it's great having a computer. Can you afford the software and the licenses that make the computer work? So there's a flow concerned with this, and it has to be managed fairly. So we want to have stakeholder involvement. Firstly, that must be the agencies that do the work, so they better understand how to do this complicated work. It's not complicated once you know how to ride a bicycle, but at first it's difficult and multiple agencies have different views. When we started in the UK, we genuinely did not know how the system worked and we had to learn. And that was the role of the implementation committee that I was on for 10 years. We were constantly learning. It wasn't something you pass the law and next year it all works wonderfully. It has to be nurtured. And part of that is the money to get the attention of senior managers in the first place, get the attention of politicians. And once they're in the room, then you can talk about the operational effectiveness and the fact that you need people to do the work. The money just doesn't arrive. You need to have financial investigators. And in the UK, we have accredited financial investigators who are all trained to the same standard, whatever agency they're from. They're all mentored in the workplace, so they're operationally effective, as the FATF require. And they can only work in the public sector. Now, I think there's room to develop that concept so that those people also have the same terms and conditions so they can move between agencies and benefit from customs experience and police experience and tax experience and move horizontally and have that career that way and move vertically. So we have people like me, I was a senior officer, directing dozens of financial investigators so that we have a strategic approach. And I think there's room for that to be a national thing in every country. Once you've got there, you can go international. And asset financial investigators in one country can speak to their professionals in another country because they speak the same language. One of the conveniences of CARIN, which is an international body, is that it speaks English for the most part, except in South America. And that is the language of financial investigation. And if people are trained together, then they professionally speak the same language as well. And we could get over those international boundaries and use international software, international systems, because the international people based in each country understand what the purpose of it all is. So there is a human side to asset recovery, which we don't really focus on. We focus on the databases and the new technologies and cryptocurrencies, these new exciting tech things, but we need humans to make them work. And that human is the accredited financial investigator.
So we've talked about asset recovery needs to be a policy priority in jurisdictions to enable good legislation to be written and good practice to be policies to be put in place. So we've talked about that. We've talked about how to incentivize our law enforcement and our politicians and the public who has a role to play in this as well, how to incentivize them to focus more on asset recovery. What about at the coalface then? You talk frequently about this concept of financial DNA. And maybe first of all, for the listeners who might not have heard this, can you perhaps explain what that is? What is financial DNA?
Well, the idea is grounded in criminal investigation of every contact leaves a trace, and that's in the physical world. And in the financial world, particularly with computers, every financial transaction leaves a trace. Once it's on a computer and you've made a transfer to another computer, then it's out there to be discovered. And all of our financial transactions now, it's all computerized. It's all available to be traced. Every contact leaves a trace. And particularly with new technologies like blockchain, then you can follow the trail. And this is quite new. And that's why financial investigation is a new thing. The concept of taking money from criminals is something which goes back to medieval times, to Roman times, when people were routinely deprived of their assets if they committed crimes. But now with computerization, the opportunity to do that at scale, in detail, fairly, is available because of computerization. And the DNA concept is the idea that DNA is everywhere. And I guess if you looked in my wallet, whether that's a physical wallet or a virtual wallet, then you would find where I live, where I go for holidays, where I shop, what I do, who are important to me, other people who are important to me. The financial intelligence connects people to people, people to places, people to times, people to money. It connects everything, which means you can use financial intelligence, obviously, crimes for money. And the antidote ultimately is asset recovery, taking the assets from criminals. But you can use it for any crime. You can use financial intelligence for any crime at all. There are no exceptions. We actually offered a prize at one stage in the UK in law enforcement. Can anybody come up with something that you can't use financial intelligence for? And that's the utility against public disorder, against hooliganism, against domestic violence. The utility of financial intelligence is incredible. And we need to think like criminals. Criminals are after the money. So they don't specialise in economic crime. They specialise in the crimes that make money, whether that's burglary or robbery or fraud or human trafficking or whatever it is. And as long as we continue to approach crimes by crime type, then we're going to be disadvantaged, because we need to get ahead of criminals by following the money back to the criminals, back to the crime.
And you're absolutely right. I mean, this is one of the failings that we saw quite frequently. And I was always amazed that we might go to a jurisdiction that had just established a rather large unit, for example, to an anti-corruption investigation unit or any other kind of, you know, major unit. And we would ask the question, how many financial investigators have you got? And often the answer we got back was, we have no financial investigators. And it was a huge gap that if you look at your saying that you quite often like to say is, you know, what you seize is what you get. If you can't find the assets in the first place through financial investigation, then, you know, you're not going to seize anything. That's the seizure that's important for the compensation of victims ultimately. But also, you know, in drugs crimes, arguably a victimless crime, the funds from the sale of assets that are confiscated from drug criminals can be used to combat drug crime or to support rehabilitation efforts of drug users. So it was always, to me, of great surprise why we would go to jurisdictions and there weren't any financial investigators. I mean, I would hope that that was not the case these days in the UK, but, you know, perhaps that is still the case that we don't support financial investigation across all of our departments and organisations and units that need it.
Yeah, I think you're so right. What you seize is what you get. And my experience when the Proceeds of Crime Act was first passed was talking to criminal investigators. And one of the first things I did, I went to an internal conference which had all the drug squad sergeants, the operational commanders, inspectors and chief inspectors for all the drug squads in one room. And I asked them, how many of you have ever been involved in supporting the restraint of assets? And there must have been 120 people in the room. Four people put their hand up at the back, which was actually the financial investigation team for one of the drug squads. But the other criminal investigators had no involvement at all in seizing assets or looking for assets. And frequently I've been to countries where they say, well, you know, once we find some assets, then we'll deploy a financial investigator to present it in court. And clearly there's a catch-22 there, because if you don't have a financial investigator, you won't find the assets, because criminal investigators won't look. They're looking for evidence of crime. They're looking at criminal intelligence from a product point of view, not from a money point of view. And we found, when we were talking about criminal intelligence, the use of informants, we found that informant handlers were asking criminals, informants, about the product. They never asked about the money, never asked how it was sold, how the economics of it worked, because that's not how people are promoted. That's not how people in the police force are successfully transferred in their careers. They're rewarded for tackling crime, not the proceeds of crime. And they simply never asked the question. And that's the issue. When we found cash, we left it where it was. When we were dealing with drug dealers, we never asked them about the money. When we were dealing with the handlers of stolen goods, we never asked them how they bought the goods. We never asked them how they sold the goods. We just found them with the stolen goods and we charged them with that crime. So It requires a different mindset, and you need people to do the work. You need the financial investigators to explain. It's a wonderful career, can I say, to get involved in financial intelligence, financial investigation. I work with wonderful people in teams. Diversity was particularly strong. You want people from different backgrounds, different ages, different investigative specialisms to be in your financial investigation team. The best financial investigators were actually the best detectives, then given a bit of knowledge about financial systems and how finance works. And that's where you get your skill set, because the best financial investigators are the best detectives, because they've got this wonderful extra power using the Proceeds of Crime Act and equivalent legislation. And they can use the money laundering powers to access international requests, because if you put money laundering in your international request, you get a better response from other countries. If you put money laundering in your case, then you can access the intelligence from financial intelligence units. If you put money laundering in your case, then you're going to do better searches, because you're going to be searching for the proceeds of crime, not just the drugs. One of the early simple examples I can give was an officer who was searching for drugs in a bedroom, found lots of drugs, found lots of cash wrapped up, scrunched up in the drawer. He fished through all the cash, found the drugs at the bottom, put the drugs in the bag, and there's so much cash in the drawer, it fell on the floor. So being a tidy officer and respectful officer, he then picked up the cash and stuffed it back into the drawer and closed it. And luckily, he was with another detective who'd been on a financial investigation course, who said, "We can actually seize that cash." The guy said, "What? Yeah, it's a new power. We can seize that cash." And that's exactly what happens in real life. We're trained as police officers not to seize the cash, not to look for the assets. It requires a change of culture. And it requires a change of culture at every level, operational, middle management, senior management. The cash and the money coming back, the asset reuse, is the catalyst to get people to make that change and think about crime more effectively, more efficiently, in a different way.
And you, Tristram, I think some of the listeners from maybe the more developed jurisdictions that are listening in, like the UK, might think that the example you've just given is something that's way in the past. But you and I both know that that is not the case in all jurisdictions. And even with the new international standards that we have, with the European Union has just introduced a fantastic new directive that focuses on great new legislation for asset recovery. We've got the FATF amended recommendations that we've referred to, also the new asset recovery guidance. The Council of Europe are also now introducing a protocol to the Warsaw Convention, all these fantastic standards. But we know that without a financial investigator or without a focus on seizure of assets, then we're not going to get to the point where we have any assets to confiscate. And you're referring to cash. We now have this difficult situation, I will call it a difficult situation, where we're expecting our seizing officers to understand where to look for digital assets and how to seize digital assets and manage that. So, you know, there are new things that we're having to tackle, that we're having to deal with. And without this kind of financial investigator focus, then we're just not going to get there. I wanted to also touch briefly on statistics with you, because I know this, again, this is another area that you've been involved in throughout your career. And there's some very relatable and funny stories in your book that you've written, that you referred to there, about being asked to write crime recording statistics back in the ESA kind of crime recording system that allows senior management to dedicate resources in the right areas. But in terms of proceeds of crime statistics, we're kind of really being shaken up by the EU at the moment, the European Union jurisdictions. They now have to focus on the statistical reporting of assets recovery. They're being asked to report annually on statistics around valuation of assets that they're seizing, values of assets that are confiscated, the fluctuation in the values while assets are under management. And it's another reason why jurisdictions are having to kind of introduce new systems that allow for this, because, you know, they just don't have systems to record statistics. And it's one of the reasons why Asset Reality has been providing its platform to jurisdictions so that they can do that. I very much enjoyed the stories of, you know, you saying you go to a jurisdiction and you ask, how many assets have you confiscated in the last year? And the answer is what, Tristram?
Generally three or four.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, what is it? You can't count to four? And also with that level of asset seizure, then yeah, computers are a good idea, but actually you probably need a ledger at first. And then once your systems work, your administrative systems, then you can develop the computers. I've got a lot of sympathy actually with policymakers and people who are responding to the European need for statistics, because there are numbers everywhere, particularly in asset recovery. So many different ways that you can count things. And I think it's really important to keep it simple, because there are only a few things that matter. The first is that this is about people. Ultimately, it's about we're deterring people's behaviour. So we need to know how many people we are deterring. So a key statistic is how many people had their assets seized. And then you can go on to how many assets and what were they worth. But how many people had their assets seized? And then down the line, it's going to be confiscated. So how many people had their assets confiscated? And what was the value of that confiscation? And then that feeds into asset reuse, how much money is coming back into the system, why it's not going to communities, why it's going to the treasury, into their central fund, rather than getting the cake bigger and recovering more assets. So just those few statistics, how many people had their assets seized, how many people had their assets confiscated a few years later, and what was the value? That's all you need. Over time, that will tell you whether you're doing better or worse. And if you link it to crime stats, then is it reducing crime? And my firm belief is that POCA reduced crime after it was passed in 2003, because it just so happened that asset recovery went up enormously, with tens of thousands of people losing hundreds of millions of pounds. And at the same time, those crimes for money fell. Maybe there's a connection. And I do feel it seems obvious that disrupting a market, at least through asset recovery, makes a difference and deters criminal behaviour. And ultimately, that's what this is about.
But we need to know, don't we, where we are in jurisdiction. And, you know, the only way really to know that is to understand what the baseline is in order to be able to kind of monitor performance and see if we're getting any better. And the only way really to have that baseline is to have a good statistical reporting system.
And one that feeds across multiple agencies, because it's not just about police, not just about prosecutors. There are lots and lots of agencies, actually hundreds of agencies in the UK, because local authorities, local government are also involved in this. So you need to have a system which all those agencies feed into, so they can keep track of their assets and they can do it on a multi-agency basis. And a lot of countries keep their statistics at the individual court that made the decision, which makes a national approach very difficult without a computer system to help.
And these days, of course, we now have the introduction of national asset management offices. I mean, the UK has recently established its own UK asset management office for policing, but it's a very new agency. So we'll see where that's going to develop and which direction that's going to move in. But across the rest of the European Union, asset management offices are being established, and you know, many jurisdictions have had them for several years. You and I have worked a lot in the Balkans in the past, and we know that the Balkan jurisdictions have had asset management offices for over 15 years now. And I think there's a lot of investment in placing the statistical reporting in asset management offices. We're being told it'll be the asset management office's responsibility, or perhaps the asset recovery office's responsibility. But in reality, the system starts with the seizing officer. And as you've explained, we're very used to working in silos, and that doesn't really bode well for a good system of end-to-end statistical reporting.
If I was going to have another go at all of this, having had this, as you said, a really interesting career, being 10 years on the National Committee in the UK and in operational command of financial investigators at the time. And then another 10, 15 years in the international area of capacity building all over the world. It's a fascinating career to be in, and I commend it to people who are setting out. But when it comes to investigation, when it comes to asset recovery, what we need to know is, well, how many accredited financial investigators do you have in your force area, in your country? Because that answers the question. If the FATF put that in their recommendations, to have accredited financial investigators and to know how many we have, then we'd be taking this seriously and we'd have some real investment in the area of financial investigation, without which nothing. What you seize is what you get. Without a financial investigator, you have nothing to bring to the table to reuse or to reinvest. And also, criminals have escaped with the money because of your negligence in not having a financial investigator. Let's put it like that.
And just before we finish off, I wanted to ask you, Tristram, if you had a magic wand and you could go into jurisdictions with that magic wand and wave it, what would be the one, maybe I'll allow two, that you would like to be able to change just by waving that wand?
I think people who haven't done this find it difficult to understand. So my magic wand would be really quite simple. All countries have this law to seize cash at the borders. They all have it. And if you just bring it inland, then it changes everything. And the reason it changes everything is because if you're walking up to the border carrying dodgy cash, then you're coming to that border with an explanation, maybe with some supporting false documents, maybe with a particular line about how you're going to explain this cash at the frontier. If you bring that power inland, then cash is found during a warrant for drugs or for stolen goods. The money that's found as well is already tainted. And we only need to taint the money once to begin the process of asset recovery. Criminals have to keep their money clean, looking clean all the time. We only have to see that one time to taint the money. And the easiest route in is cash, because hundreds of millions of pounds in cash is found all the time, all over the world. We need that power in the hands of the front line against crime. So that would be my wish.
And why is that so powerful? I mean, what generally happens when law enforcement officers seize cash? You know, in your experience, and of course, I would caveat that with there's a suspicion around that cash, and that's the reason it's seized. But what generally happens in those cases?
Firstly, the cash that's seized is litigated, and it's quite exceptional to give it back. So it's almost always forfeit by the government authorities. The initial seizure makes criminals very unhappy, because that's the cash they need to continue their business. Or it's cash that's owed to someone else, which gives them other problems. Or it's money that they have worked very hard at their criminal activity to create. And they've agglomerated the cash. The cash has built up and it's their profit. And suddenly it's gone. So it's an immediate disaster. It's something which makes people think about their behaviour, because suddenly everything they worked for, everything that they've taken risks for, suddenly it's gone, and it's permanently gone, because the authorities typically confiscate that cash as well. And it then leads to further investigation of money laundering and their other assets. And we start to investigate that person and their wife and their sister and their mother-in-law and their parents are tied into the investigation. And this changes the risk. Prison is part of the risk built into being a habitual criminal, running a criminal life. But the risk that your mother-in-law gets arrested because she's caught up in the money, because you've given her a house or you've given her the money to handle. This is a new level of risk, having your mother-in-law arrested. From experience, it's an extremely effective way to bring the full attention of the criminal to the activities they've been doing. Having their wife or daughter or mother-in-law arrested is a real issue. And I know I'm being quite sexist here, but the reality of research shows that the vast majority of criminals are men. The gender split between money launderers is pretty even. because money launderers tend to be ordinary people who just have criminals in their life.
I think the money laundering topic is probably another one for a whole different podcast that we could have. Is there anything else, Tristram, that we need to cover?
I suppose there is something, and I'll just say a piece and we'll decide whether to keep it in. I think it's really important to have financial investigators at the front line. And this is because we need to have financial investigators connected to crimes that are being reported, criminals are being arrested at the front line, because that way you have the best opportunity for asset seizure, the best opportunity for early use of financial investigation. And the reality is, if we don't have that local financial investigators at the front line, then the criminal investigators don't know who to call, may not have anyone to call, may not have somebody readily available to assist them with issues like crypto seizure, like the use of telephones and computer equipment, which accredited financial investigators can help them with. So we need these people at the front line to focus criminal investigators and ordinary police officers into the importance of assets. And there are so many occasions where uniform officers on patrol have actually suddenly got engaged in asset recovery. And I'm thinking of a particular case, a driver driving through London, stopped by the traffic police for not having a safety belt on. He seems to be behaving nervously, so they decide to conduct a search and they find £40,000 in cash in the car. When they go to the detectives in the centre of London, they say, well, we're terribly busy, can you deal with it? And that leads to a search just north of London in Northamptonshire, where they find £1,000. Now, part of that money goes to the force, and in the Met's case, the unit that did the seizure. So the traffic police suddenly had this real benefit to their work, and the result was they had their own financial investigation team doing the work. And I do think it's important to recognise financial investigators working on their own are ineffective. They've got to be part of a team in order to be effective, so that when someone's on holiday or they're not available, the work carries on. And criminal investigators can't do the work of financial investigators. That's why we have parallel investigation, criminal investigators working with financial investigators to bring that synergy so that assets are seized in the first place, all the time, every time.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Something to add?
So Tristram, thank you very much for your time on the podcast and also for the years of dedicated work that you've put towards ensuring that we've got good asset recovery laws and systems and practice in place. I wish you all the very best with the next book that you write. And I would urge everybody to read The War on Dirty Money if they have not already, in particular, if you have a law enforcement background. There's plenty of material in there that you can relate to. But yeah, I wish you all the very best going forward, Tristram. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Jill. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks to Asset Reality for the chance of talking about the exciting world of financial investigation. See you next time.
Our podcasts are for informational purposes only. They are not intended to provide legal, tax, financial, and/or investment advice. Listeners must consult their own advisors before making any decisions on the topics being discussed.